Well, good afternoon. Well, thank you very much to be here. It's a great pleasure for me to be here to present this this topic, and I'm going to try to well kick off with well something which will be an overview of the topic. It's not going to be very intense in terms of content. You won't see too many formulas and calculations in my presentation, but I guess maybe it's a good opportunity to take a step back and start this this session with let's say practitioners and traders overview of this field. I've been myself involved in capital structure arbitrage. I'd say mostly in my previous life when I was at SocGen from 1989, early 89 to 2002. At SocGen, I was in equity derivatives, and I was responsible from the proprietary trading activities, and in particular this type of activity, from the beginning up until late 99 when I left SocGen. And then in 99, I moved to JP Morgan, and I was in charge of the credit derivative business in New York. But we also had our own version of capital structure arbitrage at JP Morgan. But this time, it was more to support the flow business of credit derivative trading. So I've seen, let's say, this activity or this type of activity both from a prop trading side and being part of an equity derivative trading group. And I've also seen the same thing working as, let's say, a way to hedge and manage the inventory of a dealer in credit derivative trading. And then in 2002, I moved to credit portfolio at JP Morgan. So that's where I ended my let's say, my time on this type of trading, and I was in charge of the credit portfolio transactions worldwide for JP Morgan up until last year, and I'm now based in London, and I'm doing capital advisory for JP Morgan. So since middle of last year, I'm actually no longer involved in any trading. So most of my talk will be very much past experience, and my recollection of this business in the 90s, mostly. But I've also had discussions preparing this with some of my friends and former friends that are still in this business. Some of them have joined hedge funds and well are now in charge of these type of activities for the hedge funds they are running. So I guess the presentations from people following me will certainly bring information and content about models and more quantitative type research. I'm going to stay very much on the practical side and once again trying to plumb the stage a little bit of what this activity is and what are the, let's say, the facts around it and my own personal experience around how things are working in practice. So it's very much thinking of this as, well, we have the model, let's assume it's there on the shelf somewhere. Now what can we do with it and what are the difficulties to apply it in practice and the things you have to pay attention to. So I'll start with a brief overview of the insights and all of the high level concepts behind that. Some things around the boundary conditions, what's happening, at the boundaries, around the default and etc. Then I'll move back more around how these things translate into the dynamic life of this type of activities, all the rebalancing of the portfolios, the rebalancing of the hedges, all of these things are relatively important, and you have a lot of, let's say, practical ways of doing it, which are important. And that's what I call the dynamic risk management part. Then I will have a little section on, things which have nothing to do with the models or the quant side, but more around the external context, the credit cycle in general, what the companies are doing, and all of these other aspects, which are very important to understand what's going on in the market and how your P&L may or may not, react to the what's going on in the market, in the equities market, in the credit market in general. And I will end with maybe some words around future ideas or topics for people who I'm sure will bring a lot more to this topic. I'm pretty sure there's a lot more to do here. Okay, so briefly, we'll start with the original insight. So I cannot do anything but start with Black and Scholes and Merton in the early 70s. Well, at the time, I think their ideas were to describe this design, you know, how to describe the liabilities of a company with the language or the newly invented instruments, the calls, the puts, and obviously it's thanks to them, and since that day we have this idea that these options language is also adapted to describe what's going on in the on the liability side of a balance sheet. I think in 1976, from the article of Black and Cox, we have maybe the first article which is no longer mostly about options, but really about trying to find this equivalent of this notion of default. What does it mean, default, and something which is was more going toward trying to find a way to characterize this notion of default. And that's, I think, where we have this very important topic of this notion of a barrier which is triggered by an asset value which has drifted down over time. And I think from that time we have the first, let's say, ingredient of these structural models. Then obviously I'm sure most of you are familiar, some of you certainly more than me, of the extensive field of research that took place in the 70s and 80s to refine all of these ideas. So obviously making the evolution of the asset variable a little bit more sophisticated with jumps and etc. I think Merton himself wrote something about this. You have a lot of things that can be done thinking of path-dependent evolutions. Covenants have been reviewed already in the article of Black and Cox, but they have a very obviously importance, and they are reviewed in many articles. I think there's a very there's an article from Leland in 1994 which goes deeper into these covenants and tries to extract an endogenous way to determine this default point. And I think this was, I mean, for me at least, something which drew a lot of a new field of interest into the topic. And this, I think in this article, Leland is bringing a lot of concepts such as distress cost, agency cost, the importance of the tax shield and that stuff, as a way to refine this understanding of the asset value and the fact that this asset value is a value of the assets in place, but it's also the future value of future business opportunities. And, well, if you are in distress financially, you can no longer invest to capture these markets and these new opportunities. So there's a cost of this, which is either a real cost because you have to worry about what the next story you're going to say to your banker, as opposed to worry about your clients, and you have opportunity cost of missed opportunities. And so all of these things are very real, and there's obviously a lot of value which is lost in the context of distress. So the sum of the parts, I mean the basic concept of Modigliani and Miller is obviously wrong, not only because of tax shield, but also because of the fact you can't do everything at the same time, and as soon as you're worried about your survival, you're no longer doing what you should for growing your business and etc. Then more recently, I have seen, although I'm not sure I've understood everything, but I've seen many interesting things about the asymmetry of information, uncertainty about the measurement, ability to observe values and etc. But there's also articles around the bargaining power, game theory, and etc., which are also pretty interesting to understand the real life of capital structure arbitrage. What I've seen in the past decade was mostly a trend toward simplification of some of these ideas. So with the development of commercial models toward, you know, really using this to measure credit risk, and obviously the development of credit derivatives, there was suddenly a brand new opportunity to, let's say, do a different type of academic research as opposed to refine how you explain default and all that stuff. You bring these quantitative works toward as tools to help the development of commercial applications or new financial products, create derivatives and etc. So, once again, the structural Merton models with this idea of default triggered by an asset value and the fact that this barrier or this trigger point is related to the firm indebtedness of the firm, I think has been the core ingredient of many successful commercial applications. That's the default, distance to default concept of KMV, EDFs, and all of these other types of tools. I mentioned credit grades, which I participated to develop, but I know Barra has developed something equivalent, which is more sophisticated, which tries to capture the indebtedness in a more sophisticated way. Well, there are for sure plenty of opportunities to make better models around that field. There's also what I call the latent structural model. So that's obviously what's behind all of the credit metrics and a lot of the underlying methods to correlate asset values to price CDOs, multi-name credit derivatives, and others. So here, you know, you kind of forget about the debt or whatever. You just say, I don't care. I will calibrate this barrier level from my observation of the default probabilities, or, which I itself get from the credit spreads. But that's ultimately what is underlying a lot of very, very important and successful commercial applications. Well, another, I would say, field or branching from all of this is what I call the exotic equity derivative approach. So here you say, okay, in the end, I don't need to have an asset value concept. The only thing I need is to have the full description of the stock behavior, including, you know, what's going on when the stock goes to very low levels. And then you describe in a much more sophisticated way the evolution of the stock price, the skew, what's going on in the low strikes, and you define default as the stock reaching a very low level. But from these building blocks and ideas, you can do a lot of of equity derivative construct, which are looking very much like credit. So I'm sure you've heard about the risk reversal strategy, which has been put together by Miodraj Janjusevic from JP Morgan. But you have other people who've made research on non-parametric models and are trying to extract from the skew of the equity derivative the implicit probability of default. Well, don't need to mention about reduced form intensity models. These models are obviously are even simpler in their spirit. They kind of entirely forget why. They just focus on what's happening, and just from the notion of things after default, we go to their recovery value, which, well, for the case of the stock, would be zero. You just extract the probabilities, etc. And obviously, these reduced form intensity models are the most heavily used tools in all of the credit derivative, credit trading fields. The most recent models I want to mention here are what I call risky equity models, which are a blend, I would say, of the exotic equity derivative and the reduced form ideas. And my feeling, maybe I'm wrong on this, but my feeling is these models certainly will be the ones that prevail in the future, because with the multiplication of products, of things that you have to make consistent between the credit world, the equity derivative world, this ability to, I would say, co-calibrate on all of these different markets is going to obviously become more and more core I would say, core ingredient for to make sure you really quantified all the relevant information that's in the market. Well, I mentioned convertible bonds. Tom, I guess it's your topic, but obviously they are one of the most complicated products and one of the products which will require this type of model in the future. Okay, my own personal view of the pluses and minuses of all of these approaches. What I like in the Merton structural approach is the fact that you have some kind of intuition. It's very convenient for the multi-name extension, these asset volatility ideas and concepts. On the negative side, well, you have a lot of unobservable parameters. Well, that's for sure. And the debt parameters you have to feed into these are always very difficult to assess. The exotic equity derivative approach, in my mind, the good news is you don't need to worry about the debt levels and all of this financial analysis part. However, in my sense, it's a little bit over-specified in terms of the kind of trades you need to do in the equity derivative world. It's the default event itself, you have to define it quite precisely in terms of stock price, and there's a big chance that it's not going to happen like this. And the package of options that you have to put together, these risk reversals and that stuff, is usually very heavy. So if you are an equity derivative dealer, you can do all of these transactions at mid-market. Maybe there's a chance you can survive, but if you have to pay the bid offers and that stuff, there's no way, practically, that you can conduct a successful arbitrage activity on these grounds. However, on the index side, I have a few discussions with people, practitioners, who are telling me that when you try to do this with a basket of credit against equity derivatives on the index, so trying to capture the skew of the S&P 500 or other types of equity derivative index, you capture something which is, well, important thanks to these methods. The reduced form models, everybody, I guess, know their advantages. They are extraordinarily powerful to value credit products and credit derivatives. In my experience, where they sometimes fail, so first of all, they don't give that much insight into the value of the equity. So you don't have a clear debt-equity arbitrage relationship. Second, sometimes the time decay is very misleading. That's usually not that much of a problem for the general, you know, investment-grade credit. But when you're dealing with very distressed situations, with spreads of thousands of basis points or whatever, I mean, beware. Intensity models are potentially totally off, you know, what's going on in the real world. And I will go a little bit more into this afterwards. Risky equity multimodal models obviously are the future, hopefully, and have the ability to have this long-term link between all of these parts, the way, you know, structural models do. At the same time, have the ability to decorrelate things in the short term, and that's very important. In terms of the minuses, I guess that's more a question of practitioners, and so, you know, a lot of this needs to be digested, and I'm not sure the practitioners are there yet, and I'm not sure many people in the fields are able to really use these models the way they should be. Okay, so let's now go back to the default event itself. Well, the definition of default itself is very unclear and unprecise. Well, I put here the three keywords of the credit derivative world, but it took several years for the credit derivative dealers and lawyers and stuff to describe what default means, and I'm sure we are not finished, so that's number one. The definition itself is very difficult to capture. Then you have two difficulties. First of all, default can happen for many different reasons, and that's what I call the causality. And you have a lot of ways for a company to end up in default. It can be a question of, you know, balance sheet. So it's a good company with good operations, but it has a very bad balance sheet, too much debt, whatever. It can be the opposite. The company has a reasonable amount of debt, but it's just like its operations are messed up, and they have to fix their operational leverage and stuff. Well, these you may not see through the liability side, but these are two different ways of getting into default, potentially. You have also companies that may end up in bankruptcy or in default because of core insolvency, but it can be just a liquidity crisis, problems, especially with very fast-growing companies. There's a credit crunch, the access to the capital markets is shut down, they have a refinancing or something going wrong with their banker or whatever, and it's just an illiquidity problem. But nevertheless, it may end up in a default. Obviously, you have all of the issues around parent, subsidiary structures. We usually see companies on a consolidated basis, but in the real world, there's a lot of things going on between what the bankers want, and they want to be at the obviously operational subsidiary level, but ultimately the debt may be at the parent level. You have to have dividends paid internally. All of these things can have a real practical impact on the nature of default. Well, not to mention local bankruptcy laws and all that stuff. There's also a very important point around the timing of default. When we think of default, we usually think of the time I learn about it and the time, you know, it's public or it's in the newspaper or on Bloomberg. Most of the time, in practice, the default has happened a lot earlier than that. And the decision is made one day by the bank or by the management of the firm that it will default on that particular day. And it's calling the bankruptcy lawyers and that stuff, and it may take a few months before they work out all of the steps that they will take and what's going on with their U.S. subsidiary and whether they will bankrupt it as well or not, and all of these different steps take time. Well, when you're on the public side, you have no clue of what's going on. And, the fact that one more day happened with no news on Bloomberg doesn't mean that you're going to get paid or not paid. It's just like you don't know. And this is usually what could be bringing a lot of issues around the difficulty to modelize the time decay, especially of short-term maturities, especially with intensity models. Well, obviously, you know, I mean, but legally speaking, you also have the ability for a company to, or for the bankruptcy judge or whatever, to a payment that was made, you know, the week before default can eventually be forced back by the bankruptcy judge. So the fact that you receive the money doesn't necessarily mean that it's your money. So people have to be aware of that. Okay, so now more about the boundary conditions. Here are a few examples of situations where the default and the stock price were not at all related. So I mentioned for memory, but these are very famous cases. Everybody should have them in mind. But you have had cases in the past where there were defaults and the stock was very, very far from zero. And this was mostly for legal reasons, dispute, and the debtor, the creditor, the debtor felt that it was in a much better shape, protected by the bankruptcy code to make these negotiations. Although it was still solvent, as opposed to try to negotiate these as an ongoing concern. So, well, Columbia Gas, Texaco, Edison International were situations like that. There's also situations where the stock price goes to zero and there's no default. So in Europe, I remember Eurotunnel being something very similar to this. A lot of the famous convertible bond issued in the early 90s by Eurotunnel was never impaired, although the stock price was hugely diluted and banks had to take a cut as well. In Japan, you have the cases of Nippon Credit Bank, LTCB. These banks were, taken over by the Japanese regulators, the shares were canceled for 1 yen or for almost zero. I think all of the creditors got paid, including subordinated creditors. And they got not only paid, but guaranteed by the Japanese government and that stuff. I think the most recent case I have in mind is American Airlines in early 2003. American Airlines was really about to default. The stock price was just a fraction of its debt per share, and actually turned around and never defaulted. A lot of people who had, you know, strategies which were based on an extremely low price, for them, it was done. I mean, American Airlines was sure to default. Didn't happen. Well, the second bullet here is what I was mentioning about these very short maturity payables, and the fact that time at the limit, at time equals zero, so money that I should be paid today, I mean in 1 second, the probability is neither zero nor one. You still have a little residual that you should keep in mind. That is the fact that default is still messy, even the day of the payment. And obviously the more the company is risky, the more you're dealing with an entity which may already have taken the decision to default, the more obviously this is going to be extraordinarily important. Well, so my conclusion about this, the boundary conditions have an incompressible level of uncertainty. So I think the goal of all of this work is not to be precise, but to have a consistent way of quantifying the information that's available and to apply it across a large number of situations. And then you have a way to benchmark what's going on and compare company A, company B, and all of this, and do your job of, I think this all is all very important for the success of the field, but we will never get to an absolute level of precision. The second point, obviously, is the fact that if you're running any activity of capital structure arbitrage, you need to have stress losses limits and the way to bound your event risk losses. And, well, I mentioned here LBOs, mergers, and et cetera. But obviously, all of these things happen, and you have to be sure that if such a thing happens, you're not losing more than what's acceptable for your business. I'm going more now into the the dynamic part of the job. So most of the dynamic nature of this is this, let's say derivative idea where you replicate a portfolio and you delta hedge continually to replicate the profiles. So here in the case of capital structure arbitrage, you have to remember that you don't have an underlying. You have different securities, and also you model them as being based on the same underlying, such as the asset value. It's not the reality. And you can see the stock, the bond as a derivative of the stock price, but you could also see the stock as a derivative of the bond price. And this simple idea has a lot of consequences in terms of your what the models are telling you. You can say, I have a fixed amount of bonds, I have $1 million worth of bonds, and I'm going to hedge it by constantly readjusting a delta in shares. Okay, and then, so obviously, what's important to me is the volatility of these shares and blah, blah, blah. Okay, but you can also say, and there's no reason, I'm going to buy 10,000 shares, and that's fixed, and I'm going to every day change my delta in bonds. And then what's going to matter is what's the volatility of these bonds or these spreads and et cetera. And there's no reason a priori to say that one is better than the other. So here I give an example. Assuming you have, calibrated all of your models, your parameters, there's no uncertainty on anything. In the market, the stock price is at 11. And the credit default swap, here it's not a bond, it's a credit default swap, is trading at 457 basis points. Well, here you say, okay, there's an arbitrage opportunity. I can buy bond or sell protection, sell CDS at 457 basis points, and I'm going to short shares. Well, and I should make money. Either the stocks will go back down, or the spread will tighten, but I don't know, but something should happen and I should make money from that arbitrage. Now the question is, okay, but now what should I base my delta on? Should I say, oh, the stock price is 11, so my delta is minus 10,000, and I should hedge myself by buying 10,000 shares, and or buying 740 million, sorry, thousand worth of bonds, or should I trust the CDS quote or par spread? And this time my model is telling me that I am long, and I should actually sell shares. And this is reality. There's uncertainty about your delta just by the fact that you have several securities and they are telling you different stories. So, I tried to express this in a more, let's say, quantitative manner by saying, okay, what can we say about this? First of all, if you go back to the stock versus bond relationship, you have two cases. Either you say, okay, I trust my stock price, so that I was calling case one, okay, and I have a theoretical bond price, which is the high price, and now I look at my real market bond price, which is the case one below. So then you say my theoretical profit is what I call P0 here. It's the difference between this theoretical price for the bond and the price at which I'm able to buy it. Okay? That's, let's say, what the theoretical model is telling me in terms of my expected profit. If I had taken the other view, which was to say, okay, the stock price is supposed to go down, and I'm going to consider it's a fixed amount of stock, which I'm going to rebalance with a variable amount of bond. Then the model, the same model, is telling you that your expected profit is P1, is a higher profit. Okay? My view is that usually, when you have this type of situation, between a lower expected profit and it's usually the most likely outcome, or it's a more prudent way when you have several ways to evaluate your expected profit. The one which is giving you the lowest value is usually the one which has the lowest standard deviation. It's usually the one which is associated, I'd say, with the safest hedging strategy. On top of that, here, you see that it's also the lowest delta. So to me, it's another reason why it's usually the better strategy, because you may be frequently in these situations where you have a tendency to overestimate the delta, because these structural models assume a correlation of one between, obviously, between the stocks and the bonds, which in reality does not happen, at least short term. So let's say there's a little bit of a discrepancy between the structural model approach in terms of its deltas and, let's say, a CAPM type approach, where you would multiply, the ratio of volatilities by a correlation, which would be less than one. So I think usually this tends to give a more correct assessment of the delta. At the opposite, I take the case two, when you have an expensive bond and a relatively cheap equity, you more or less get to the same conclusion. So I can let you go over the what-if cases, but you can see that the profit based on the highest price is lower and with a slightly lower delta. Okay, so there's another way, is to calibrate and say, okay, now what if I force one of my inputs, my parameters, to be such that the market price of the bond or the credit default swap is exactly the one which corresponds to my observed stock price. And what is the delta that I get from this? So obviously now the question is, what parameter should you calibrate? Is it the volatility? Is it the debt per share? Is it the recovery rate? What is the parameter which you feel you are the less sure about, or the one which you think should be the driver? Most of the time it's the volatility, but I know a lot of people are also using this type of calibration process to adjust the debt per share or to adjust the recovery rate. Okay, so usually it's a blend of these things. Well, as you can see, when you do this calibration process, every one of them is giving you a different delta, Well, the good news is they are not so different from each other, and they usually fall in the range, I would say, of the deltas which I gave you previously. So there's a relatively good robustness of all of these various ways to approach the problem. I'd say as long as you don't have totally ridiculous implied levels. So you have to monitor your implied parameters, and whenever you get an asset volatility, which is like 1.5%, or a debt per share, which is totally crazy, or recovery rate, of which makes no sense, of 98, well, obviously it's wrong, and you should not rely on any such calibration. Okay, I can skip this in the interest of time, but that's, I think, the same ideas are giving also insight into what you do with your managing your gamma, your vega, and etc. I guess I need 5 minutes to speak a little bit about let's say, what's going on away from your models and your own trading businesses. I think it's important to have in mind the what I call the life cycle of companies. So I've summarized it here with these 5 steps, you know, from the startup, you know, emerging growth, mature stage, and what's going on when companies are declining. Obviously, along the road, the leverage of the company naturally changes. It's, I would say, the volatility of its activities is obviously following a declining stage as the company is growing and become more and more mature. But then things reverse when you get into a point where company is having reduced margins, difficulties to compete, and we are at this declining stage point. Also, the cash flows here can be important because, as you can see, at different stages of their life, the companies may or may not need the capital markets. So if you're a mature company, you're paying money to the markets every year because you're paying dividends, and you don't need the markets. If there's a credit crunch, it doesn't affect you. If you're an emerging company which has a huge need of financing, you're dead. I mean, your plans and a lot of your value evaporates if there's a credit crunch. I think it's also, so it's interesting to understand the dynamic of volatility. It's interesting to understand the dynamic of the forward debt that you may have to assess, whether the company has a realistic way to, you know, to finance its capital expenditures and stuff. It's also interesting to understand the term structure of volatility, which is usually mean reverting and sloping down for high volatility type companies, but usually up for investment grade and low volatility type company. The other aspect is the, I would say, macroeconomic cycle. Very important. I've dotted, it's a chart here, which this is the equities market in the vertical axis, and this is the credit spread on the horizontal axis. So as you can see, and this is the year, you know, 98-2000, equities were up, but the spreads were more or less staying where they were, and volatilities were not going down. That was a time where companies were growing a lot, investing a lot of debt was building up. So although equities almost doubled, or more than doubled, there was no, the credit spreads stayed where they were. 2000 to 2003, well, that's the burst of the TMT bubble or whatever. Well, obviously here you have the, I would say, normal relationship, stocks going down, volatility going up, spreads going up, so that's what you would expect. And then since, I would say, late 2002, early 2003, you had a different type of evolution where this time companies are rebuilding a bit their balance sheet, deleveraging. Stocks are moving sideways, a bit up, but it's not, there's no big trend, you know, on the upside. But the big trend is on the volatility side, a big trend down on the volatility, a big trend down on the spreads that we have seen up until maybe the months of April or May of this year. So it's important to understand where you are, and you shouldn't be surprised of the fact that these different asset classes have their own dynamic and their own way to move. So this drives me to my last part, which is the fact that you need to, when you do this type of activity, you need to diversify your arbitrages. You can't be all the way long equity and short bonds, or all the way long bonds and short equities. If you do this, you're dead for sure. Because there's too much of these big moving parts. So you need to constantly play that on a relative basis and make sure that, okay, I'm going to have arbitrages which are long equity, short bonds, and I'm going to have arbitrages which are the other way. So I can always monitor my, what I call my idiosyncratic position, so company by company, and make sure I have a relatively good hedge. But I can also look at my overall portfolio of equities and say, okay, forget all of the bonds. I'm looking at only my equities, long short, my put options, my call options, all of my equity stuff. What's my overall equity exposure? Okay, and it must stay within a reasonable, let's say, level. Same thing on the credit side. Forget all of my equities. I'm just looking at my portfolio of bonds. How many bonds I am long, short, what maturity, my long maturities, my short, my convexity, all of the PVBP crap, all of that stuff. And make sure that you stay within reasonable bonds and that you can sustain, you know, stresses and the fact that the markets can decorrelate at times and still survive what's going on. And obviously, if you have ability to apply betas to the various moving parts, then you can hedge, you know, each market with its indexes by doing index trades or whatever to eventually, because at times you have big opportunities one way or another, you can mitigate that by hedging on the indexes. Oops. Okay, so I'm finished. So what's next? So a few ideas here. Bankruptcy arbitrage, I'm sure there's more to do here. There's a lot of stuff that can be done especially by hedge funds, arbitraging the different claims after bankruptcy. I remember doing some of that at SocGen, and at the time there were a lot less abilities to do this than now, so I'm pretty sure this will be a topic down the road. Obviously, there's a much richer set of financial products which will allow to calibrate and extract information for many, let's say, primary products, but all of their derivatives, the correlation products, the volatility product on the spread side, CDS options, and all of these things. And there could be new products. I've heard recovery swaps are starting to trade a bit. It's a little bit timid, but you can trade a product which only deals with the recovery value. But why not, a debt per share swap or something like this? It's definitely doable. And obviously, I mentioned here a few new models or new approaches which are more sophisticated, which I guess some of them will be presented during this conference. So I don't want to steal any of the topics of the presenters. Okay, thank you very much. I guess I'm maybe 5 minutes late, but that's it for my talk.